and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review. I'm Tom Edwards. Today we're heading to the West End with Matt Wolfe, theatre critic for the International New York Times. It's a good month for Shakespeare revivals in London as we see Kenneth Branagh bring those star-crossed lovers Romeo and Juliet to the Garrick. And over at the Globe, there's a rather unorthodox retelling of A Midsummer Night's Dream. Think Bangra, Gay Affairs and Australian Cabaret. Oh yes. All that plus a new production of Brecht and Vaux's operatic masterpiece, The Threepenny Opera. That's ahead on the Monocle Arts Review. Stay tuned. Let's get things started then at the Garrick Theatre, where Kenneth Branagh's much-anticipated production of Romeo and Juliet premiered this month to, well, rather mixed reviews. Matt, welcome to the show, first of all.
Thank you.
We've seen Romeo and Juliet in, I don't know, every possible context, yeah. Every possible period.
Yeah.
What's the idea here? Where does this one pitch up?
Well, the idea is that it's, of course, the play is set in Italy anyway. That's not radical. But the idea here is to displace it to the 1950s, sort of the Fellini-esque era of La Dolce Vita, very kind of hot-blooded passion. The women all look very glamorous. The men all look very dashing. It's a kind of black and white monochrome world, essentially. But it's a world that is quick to flare up into passion on the one hand, violence on the other. Mm. So a tempestuous landscape.
I mean, in that sense, it sounds like a perfect bedfellows. But as I mentioned in the introduction, there kind of mixed reviews. What's been the response? And is it querying with the staging? Is it something different?
Well, I would say that it's actually not a very good production.
always a problem.
Sadly, you can have, and we'll talk about this later with relation to The Dream. You can have a strong concept and still not have a production. Mm-hmm. The concept, as Shakespeare never said, doth not a production make. And in this case, you feel as if, not for the first time perhaps, a lot of emphasis has gone on devising the world of the play and not much attention to the play itself, mm-hmm. the landscape of the players. So obviously with Romeo and Juliet, the title roles are rather important. And I wasn't wild about either Richard Madden or Lily James. She has had some good reviews in the press. I wish I could share some of my colleagues' enthusiasm for her. I didn't think either one was actually very interesting. Romeo's a sort of thankless part. He's a lover really in love with love, not so much in love with Juliet. So Richard Madden does what he can. Juliet is a much better part, but I felt as if Lily James was acting everything from the outside in. It's all very sort of breathy and a bit sort of histrionic and literally breastfeeding. And she has to play act being the young teen that Juliet is. The most interesting performances in it are from some of the older actors. Derek Jacobi, Sir Derek Jacobi, who's 77, a long-standing colleague of Kenneth Branagh's. They've been mates for ages. And Jacobi plays the hot-blooded part of Mercutio.
Now, is he the oldest Mercutio ever, perhaps?
Must be by some you know, degree. He is, with respect to Sir Derek, he's a great, great actor, but he's old enough to be Mercutio's grandfather. And when he was announced for this part, I think people thought, wait a minute, that must be a mistake in the press release. He must be playing Friar Lawrence, which actually would be a very good part for him to play. The funny thing is, he's actually the best thing about the production, because first of all, he speaks the verse absolutely beautifully. And so if you just want to hear a masterclass in Shakespearean verse speaking, there it is. Secondly, he plays the part. He's not apologizing for his age. Mm. He plays it as an old man, an older man, who's kind of hanging on with this group of much younger guys to whom his relationship is a little bit indeterminate. He wields a cane. He's a bit of a dandy, a bit of a fop. And you sort of feel as if he's half in love with his own imminent death. So he treats everything like a kind of droll joke where the joke is on him. And as a result, it's actually quite affecting. And because, spoiler ahead, listeners, Mercutio dies relatively early on. When the character dies, the production loses a vital spark. Mm. The other interesting performance, which has been perhaps under-recognized by some of my brethren and sisterin, is the kind of one of the screen it girls of the 70s, Marissa Berenson, who was Ryan O'Neill's co-star in Barry Lyndon. She was in the movie of Cabaret. She was a great, great beauty in her time. She's now almost 70, but she's in the production playing Lady Capulet, and she still is pretty beautiful. And it's interesting to see this woman from a completely bygone era on a London stage, mm-hmm. and she acquits herself very well.
It's interesting, actually. It strikes me as interesting when we look at the casting end of this play. There's quite a few of the main players who maybe imagining a lot of theatre goers, or maybe new-ish theatre goers, will recognise from TV shows that they like.
Sure.
You mentioned a bit of extra kind of older era magic dust from, say, the big screen.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, is it slightly confused almost in the casting? Have they not got the balance right? Is that one of the reasons why it slightly fails to convince?
Well, I think probably, this is just a guess, Kenneth Branagh directed Lily James and Richard Madden on screen, I guess, in 2015 in the Disney film Cinderella. They were the two leads. And that was a big success. It wasn't a particularly good film, but it was a successful film. And obviously, he directed the minute they and he befriended one another. Mm. And so probably, you know, at some point, the idea was mooted, well, I, Branagh, am going to be running this West End season. Any parts for you kids? And they're... You know, their inexperience shows, particularly, I think, Lily James's Juliet, where you have to communicate the inner flame of this woman, well, girl woman, who is awakening to a world that she can't begin to understand and acknowledge. And as soon as she does, it's snuffed out.
Mm. Just finally on this, is there a problem, do you think, with, say, a play and a text even like Romeo and Juliet that is so well known, it is so beloved, but people have their favourites they've seen on stage, they have their favourites they've seen on screen, whether it's, you know, Zeffirelli or a contemporary take like Baz Luhrmann, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
Is this causing a contemporary problem for people who are trying to freshly stage something that's so well known and well loved?
Well, I think it's an issue directing Shakespeare in general, but probably particularly in the UK, where, as I think of it, these plays exist on a continual travelator, and there is nothing really you can do about it. And I always say, you know what, if you don't like the production of whatever the Shakespeare play is at the moment, don't worry, there'll be another one in 5 minutes. I mean, for instance, in the autumn, there are going to be two competing productions of King Lear at the same time, one with Anthony Scher, the other one with, of all people, Glenda Jackson. So, but those obviously already couldn't be more different. Mm. So there you go.
Romeo and Juliet runs at the Garrick until the 13th of August. We mentioned it's rich with the Bard this week. More Shakespeare. This time, a remake of A Midsummer Night's Dream, which is on stage at the Globe Theatre. But again, Matt, this is not a straightforward retelling. How's the Globe kind of shaken things up in this time?
I really love this production. I mean, in a way, this is an example of a production where the concept is radical, but it also informs every sort of particular component rather than looking at the whole and forgetting the specifics. This is the first production at the Globe by its new artistic director, Emma Rice. And Emma Rice is a hugely, hugely talented director. She has run very successfully a touring company based in Cornwall called Knee High. And now she's the third artistic director of the Globe and also the first woman. By her own admission, she's probably made too much of the fact. She said time and again, oh, I don't really know much about Shakespeare. I don't really get Shakespeare. And you think, wait a minute, you're running Shakespeare Globe. Maybe you might want to tone that down a bit. But I can understand the impulse. I think she very much wants a populist democratic Globe and productions that sort of speak to the community today. But what's lovely about this production, and she's underselling her intelligence to say she doesn't get Shakespeare, she absolutely gets this play. But she is not afraid to trim it. She's not afraid to play with it pretty radically. For instance, she turns Helena, one of the four young lovers, into a guy whose name is Helenus in the play. And actually, it's not a gimmick at all. It works very well in the landscape of confusion that the play is largely about. And in fact, it kind of solves a problem that has been in the play all along, which is why one of the lovers is so sort of needlessly cruel to another one. And if you think, well, he's grappling with something in him, then all of a sudden that problem vanishes. So it's quite a nice piece of textual tinkering. And then she's kind of cast against expectation. She's cast this Australian cabaret star, Meow Meow, as Titania. And it's a really delightful, delightful performance. I mean, really fun and feisty. And, you know, she brings... If you're a singer, you've got a sense of music and the musical. And so she treats these great Shakespearean soliloquies as if they're sort of musical lines, and she gives them the appropriate cadence. She also has a hell of a lot of fun. She's got a very interesting doubling Puck. I shouldn't say who it is, but the sprite Puck is played by a woman, and she doubles with a much older male character to be revealed. And it's it's dazzling. So all along, you're kind of, it's like watching a painting that's been covered over, sort of scrubbed clean. And you think, oh yeah, this is a modern gloss on something 400 years old. And now we get it.
Mm. Well, let me ask you about that, that sort of that texture and that complexity then, because there's quite a few different influences. We've got sort of Bangra, there's David Bowie influences
in
there. Yeah,
Beyonce gets a moment.
And so does that influence... Is it just the tone? Is it the visuals? Is it more about how it shapes the mood of the piece?
Well, I think she really understands, Emma Rice, really understands the fact that this is a play about relief and release. What happens in the play, basically, is everyone goes into the woods, like the Stephen Sondheim musical. Everyone goes into the woods, and when they're in the woods, something magical happens. That's basically the play. And it's a play about arriving at heart. At the beginning, it's very cold and austere, and there's the landscape of death, and a father threatens to disown his daughter. There's sort of an arranged marriage, which is really brutal. So you think, this seems about as forbidding as a play can be. But all of that falls away by the end. And I think she's tapped into the spirit of the play very well without necessarily the letter of the play. Mm. And because these plays were popular in Shakespeare's day, what she argues very persuasively is, okay, let's make them popular now in a way that reads now. So, for instance, the mechanicals in the play, who are the kind of Amdram actors within the play, they are, this isn't a particular spoiler, they are... act it as if they were employees at the Globe. So they would be the modern day workers now who are deciding, well, we work at this place about theater, let's put on our own play. And it turns out to be a really inspired touch. And at first you think they are actually the workers at the Globe. You think that they're just telling you to shut up. And then as it goes on, you realize, oh, wait a minute, they're the actors in the play. So it's kind of cool. It's a cool production.
There you go. That's high praise indeed. I like the sound of it. That's Midsummer Night's Dream. It's on at the Globe until the 11th of September. Let's change gears, Matt, a little, shall we, for some opera. The Threepenny Opera, to be exact, which was originally put together by Bertolt Brecht and Kurt Weill and first opened in 1928. Yes. The play is a socialist take on a capitalist world, regarded as one of the greatest artworks to come out of the Weimar Republic, of course. Matt, that's a pretty brief and fairly non-detailed
description. I'm impressed, Tom.
But it's an interesting history. Maybe you could sort of give us a bit of the kind of the storyline in case people are not familiar with the work.
Yeah, well, the thing about the Threepenny Opera is it is an iconic piece, but it's a little bit like A Midsummer Night's Dream in that you can do a lot with it. It's very elastic. I've probably seen 5 or 6 productions of it, and no two have been the same. This production is very different from any other. It's got a new adaptation by Simon Stevens, who won a Tony Award for The Curious Sense of Dog in the Nighttime. It's set in and around contemporary London now. It was originally, as you say, written in the 1920s as a kind of cautionary fable about Weimar-era Germany. But of course, the worst reaches of Weimar-era Germany hadn't even happened by 1928. So there was a sense of it being unwittingly prophetic. It's got the absolute opposite tone to Midsummer Night's Dream, whereas that's a play about the discovery of heart. This is a caustic, scabrous play, or opera in quotes, because it's a kind of mock opera. It's not grand. It's not elegant. It's grubby. It's of the street. It's very kind of down and dirty. So it's opera in inverted commas. But it, I think, works very, very well in this production. I ended up liking this production a lot. The first 20 minutes, I thought, ooh, they're groaning to make it contemporary. It seems a little bit kind of willfully hip. Some of the lyrics don't sit on the melodic line. But if you kind of go with it, it kind of pays off and it pulls together very neatly in the second act. What's very interesting about it, I think, to people who love The National, and I hope there are a lot of them out there, is that Mack the Knife, the leading character of the criminal Macheath, he's kind of the anti-hero of the piece. He's a womanizer. He's, in this one, he's kind of big into knife crime. He's not a nice guy. Think the Cray brothers. That's his world in this. And the part is played by Rory Kinnear, who's a classical actor. He played Hamlet. He played Iago in Othello. Wonderful actor. But as far as I was aware, he'd never sung before. And actually, like so many great British actors, it seems, Jonathan Pryce, even Judi Dench, it turns out he can sing very well. So that's a nice surprise. And whereas in Hamlet, of course, he had to communicate a kind of battered soul, in this one, it's all about absence of soul. This is not a character who is contrite about anything he does. He goes on the rampage and suffers the consequences or not. And again, spoiler ahead, there's a kind of faux happy ending, but the happy ending is meant entirely ironically. And you're meant to feel kind of grubby and dirty as you exit the theater. And I think in this production you do.
Always, well, I was going to say always good, but I'm not sure. Maybe let's draw a veil over that. It's interesting you talked a little bit about it's almost kind of genre-defying in a sense, yeah. Because it was this sort of satire on traditional opera. It was sort of trying to coax out a new kind almost of musical theatre. Is it still genre-bending in this iteration, do you think?
I think it really is. I mean, the thing that they can't tinker with because of the estates, and also they'd be foolish to, is Kurt Weill's glorious music. And the music really, really is fantastic. The problem, if it is one, is that the book of the show, which here is Simon Stevens's, in other words, the narrative, the language, can often look a bit piecemeal. The characters can be emblems of Bertolt Brecht as opposed to flesh and blood creations. There's this whole thing about Brecht's theatrical sort of ethos, which has to do with alienating the audience. But if you try deliberately to do that, it all looks sort of silly. Mm. But I think this production has found, I mean, a very small example, at the interval, right before they say, interval, big deal. But it announces the fact that this is a play about playmaking. And yet, because the cast is very charismatic, not just Rory Kinnear, but the wonderful Rosalie Craig, the brilliant Hayden Gwynn, who plays Mrs. Peachum. She looks like a character out of a German expressionist painting. Nick Holder playing her kind of egg-shaped, criminally egg-shaped husband. There's a wonderful performance by a disabled actor who has cerebral palsy named Jamie Bedard, and he's in a wheelchair throughout the performance. He's absolutely brilliant, and he gets the single best line in the production. And that's sort of fantastic, too, that it's inclusive in its casting, and you feel that that makes sense because Brecht and Weill and now Stevens are commenting on the world at large, mm-hmm. and the production is cast with the world at large.
What about, I mean, I don't want to end on a serious note, but there's a lot of talk, you know, post-2008 about, you know, how the world views its capitalism and how what capitalism means. Is this still an indictment of capitalism? Does it retain a contemporary relevance in that sense?
Yeah, I mean, is it like a stage version of the movie The Big Short? Probably not. I mean, I suppose the inevitable irony with this kind of production, but it's just the way it is that you're very aware of the National Theatre, the state-funded National Theatre, having spent a hell of a lot of money to put in a show about so-called poor theatre. Vicky Mortimer's sets are elaborate, but they're very scrappy. People kind of poke through them. But that scrappiness costs a lot of money to arrive at. Mm. Paradoxically, it's not cheap to look scrappy. So this is a production that probably cost a lot of, you know, corporate money in order to rail against capitalist excess. But that's the way it is. We live in a mixed economy and you just accept it.
It's on with the show, folks, isn't it? As always.
It's on with the show.
That's the Threepenny Opera. It's on at the National Theatre until the beginning of October. And that brings us to the end of today's show. Matt, thanks very much for being with us, as always. Matt Wolf, our guest. Today, you've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Tom Edwards. The show is produced by Holly Fisher and researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Join us again at the same time tomorrow. Our weekly book review awaits. But for now, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.